Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, this is your co-host, Will Bluewater. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Bluewater, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk. Welcome to Black Talk Radio with Scotty Reed. It is Wednesday, and of course, every Wednesday is Leap Day for us here. Law Enforcement Against Prohibition is an organization that is working to educate the public on the failures of the United States' current drug policy. And again, for those who are regular followers of this program, we bring a guest on who works with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, one of their speakers, and tonight our guest is James Flaming Eagle Mooney, who is a former undercover narcotics officer. Let me just read a little bit from his bio. Mr. Mooney spent more than a decade in the Utah State Law Enforcement and the State Department of Corrections, during which he was a zealous enforcer of the drug war. He was told by a supervisor, Hurricane Police Officer Kim Segmiller, that during his time undercover, he took down more people for drug charges than all the other confidential informants in the state of Utah combined. And then something happened, and James is quoted as saying that he realized that he was not part of the solution as it comes to the war on drugs, but he was a part of the problem. So it is my pleasure to welcome you to Black Talk Radio, Mr. Mooney.
Well, it's an honor to be here.
Thank you. So I was reading your bio, and, you know, you admit that you were a zealous enforcer in the drug war. You were a foot soldier. And let me ask you this question. Why were you so zealous in your duties as a law enforcement officer when it comes to drug busts? Did you have, like, a friend who overdid on drugs? Did it touch your family? Was it something personal? Or did you just buy into all the propaganda that's put out there about the drug war?
That, you know, your last statement really does describe was going through my mind. I was at a position in my life where I really wanted to contribute. And at that time, in 1987, 88, my wife died of cancer, and I was just devastated, and I really didn't think that I was searching for something that would give me some type of feeling of contribution to our society. And at that time, the propaganda that was put out by almost all newspaper agencies, television, everything was just saying this war on drug needs to be combated and overcome. And I really bought into that, and mainly with the idea of really searching for a way to serve my communities. I thought this would be the best way to accomplish that. And because of my situation, I was really in a wonderful place to be able to take advantage of that, the war on drugs, to fulfill a need in me to contribute. And when a officer came up to me, Kim Segmiller came up to me and said, "You know, James, because of who you are and the stature that you have, as being a authentic Seminole medicine man, you can really help us out." And I thought about that for almost 3 or 4 weeks, and then there's some things that happened that I realized, you know, this would be a way that I could contribute to our society. And then after 7 years of being in deep undercover work, and I did not know what good I was actually doing, because the only contact I had to society was through Kim. And when I had things that promoted me to travel, then they arranged a box, at a post office box, where they would put money into where I would take that. But nobody knew who I was other than Kim Segmiller. But then something happened, and what it really started was when I had some people wired going into this home, and there was two young people, and they did not know who I was, or I was in another car, but they were wired, and over the I could hear this little boy calling out for his mother. And I knew I was going to take his mother and father away for no less than 10 years. And that was a shock to me, to think I am being a destructive factor to a family. And it was devastating to me. And I remember just repeating in my mind that little boy's words, and I'm taking away his family or his mother and father. It was astounding to me. And then there was another thing that happened, that at this time they were really negotiating to take people's properties and things like that. And Kim said to me, he said that, you know, this drug task force official and the DEA want to meet with me up in Salt Lake City. And so he and I went up there for this meeting. It was very, very undercover the way we did it. And the building that I went into was highly secured. And I went up to the third floor, and Kim was there with about 4 or 5 other people. And they asked me, "Can I do this?" And I said, "Absolutely. You know, how about this? And can I get into this?" And some of it was international things. And I said, "Yeah." And so I left that meeting, and Kim left before I did, and we met at an undisclosed place. And as I get out of my car, Kim was already there, and I came walking up to him. He looked at me, and he said to me, "It's over, isn't it, James?" I said, "Absolutely, Kim. And now, the only reason I've been able to survive is because nobody knew who I was except you. Now there's 4 or 5 other people." He says, "I'm dead." And he says, "I totally understand." And so that was when What they were doing is offering me all kinds of money. They said that if I did this, I could make as much as $100,000, and that also turned me off because that's not what I was doing. Why I was doing that was to earn money. I was doing it as in my mind, serving my community.
So James, let me interject there. So as a informant, they were asking you to do certain jobs or infiltrate or make contact with certain people who may have been dealing in illegal drugs, and they told you you can make over $100,000 from that?
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that pretty routine for informants to make that much money?
Well, you got to remember there's three kinds of informants.
Okay.
There's one kind which they call CIs, confidential informants. And these are usually people that have been, have been arrested and so, or they've been prosecuted and they plea deal that they are able to provide some information or whatever. And those are CIs. And they're usually... usually what people are using now. And then before that, there were police officers that would go undercover, but they would be, they had conflict of interest because they cannot break a law. In other words, they could not smoke dope. They could not break any laws. And I mean, that's just, then it would be called entrapment. And so the premier undercover people are citizens that aren't police officers at the time, which I became a police officer, but at the time they're not a police officer, so they don't have that abiding by the laws of the land to
entrap people, right?
Exactly right. And so I was a premier person that was working with the police agency, the task force, actually with the Washington County Task Force of Utah, and so I was premier because I had no restrictions whatsoever. I was just merely when it was described to me, I was merely a public servant doing his public duty, and so I was just the cat's meow for the task force in the state of Utah.
And sticking with the subject of informants, I know, the United States is heavily invested in Mexico and you know, trying to prosecute the drug war down there. They gave the Mexican government, I believe it was either last year or the year before, the U.S. government gave them $1 billion to use for various reasons, but, you know, all of it in the effort to fight the drug cartels down there. And here recently, I believe it was last week, I read an article about the DEA or either the Justice Department was going to or was building a network of informants in Mexico, and this was supposed to be like this new tool that they were going to use. But interestingly, according to Mexican law, it is illegal for the United States to operate as such on Mexican soil. So had you heard about that program, and what type of informants do you think would possibly be used in networks such as that?
You know, I cannot comment on that because I've been out of the system since 1997, and so I'm really not up on it. And as a matter of fact, I really am very embarrassed about my involvement with the drug war as an undercover. I mean, a person that's undercover, especially in my situation, your entire life is a lie. I mean, it's a lie. And, I mean, you talk about being out of integrity. I mean, my gosh, anybody that works undercover, it's a lie. It's just simply a lie. And so as far as I can get, my major objective that I have in my life is to bring an end to this war that, to me, is a war on ourselves, and that has done so much disruption to the families of the United States, and it has darkened and it has totally degraded our reputation throughout this world. I mean, it's just there's nothing good about this war on drugs other than feeding people's greed and their pride, and which is just obnoxious to me.
You know,
go ahead.
Earlier you were talking about, you know, some of the cases that you were involved in, and you know how these people would be looking at these long prison sentences. And recently, in 2010, the Fair Sentencing Act was passed, which reduced the sentence disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine to 18 to 1, taking it down from 100 to 1. Now, it says that an article from the New York Times says that 12,000 inmates could have their sentences, which average 13 years, shortened by an average of 3 years. But, you know, they note that the bill still left substantial penalties for the crimes. When I read about these 12,000 inmates, and, you know, I'm not sure the general public, when they read a headline like that, or they're reading an article and it's talking about 12,000 inmates, do you think people see these inmates as being a part of the of a family, perhaps mothers, perhaps fathers? Do you think we really think about the impact that this has on a young child whose parents go to prison behind these crimes?
I think in some level they do. I really do. And so there's undoubtedly this incredibly unresolved guilt that people have. I mean, almost of the I think it's approximately 10,000? No, it's more than that. There's about 20,000 of retired, and some aren't even retired, law enforcement officials that support LEAP. And they, if you talk about someone that is being effective in ending this war, it's LEAP, because you're having judges, ex-governors, legislators, judges, people like myself that worked with the Department of Corrections as well as being undercover. They are dedicated to ending this war, because people, for some reason, want to put that in the back, that these are our own brothers and sisters. These are our neighbors. These are our family members that we are putting on this label of being a criminal for simply, in most cases, trying to self-medicate themselves. In a way that's a heck of a lot more financially feasible than it is. Like for my father, he's 80 some odd years old, and his monthly bill for drugs is over $1,500 freaking dollars, for goodness sakes. I mean, it's insane. And if people truly became conscious that it is your sons and daughters, that this is a war on ourselves. More people begin to understand that, then I hopefully things will change much, much, much faster. But the opposition that you've got going and that we have got going, I mean, LEAP officials or LEAP people, people like myself, we know the devastating effect from being on the other side of the fence. And we feel so guilty, each and every one of us. I mean, I was at the hemp harvest with a prosecuting attorney, and we were just sitting there. I mean, what we did, and we said it to ourselves, what we did to our communities is just, it's almost inexcusable. And so we're trying to make up for all the damage that we've done to our brothers and sisters, for goodness sakes. And it is working. It is working. We now have the NAACP supporting us, because it is unequivocal, and I'm sitting here right now, and I can tell you straight out, the entire war on drugs is based on racial discrimination, totally, because the war on drugs was started basically with marijuana. Okay, I'm a medicine person, okay, and I have an Aquaba Native American Church, which is the only organization that the United States federal government recognizes as a organization that supports the American Native Indigenous culture of the North and South America. We're the only ones. And the reason there's an exception to the laws to our church is that plant cactuses, herbs, vines, whatever you want to call it, anything that's grown by the earth is considered a sacrament to the Native American church. And so when they made a law against marijuana, precisely, and peyote, that was, those laws were specifically to destroy or to limit the abilities of the Native American culture to survive in the United States.
Wow. I don't think I've ever really had someone talk about that aspect of it, but as you stated, this is a part of many different cultures. I mean, especially marijuana. Marijuana has been around for as long as, you know, probably recorded history. And, you know, it is a fact that many different religions, many different cultures have used this substance. And but also, you know, you mentioned earlier about, you know, the work that you do as a medicine man, and you're a well-respected expert and leader in health and substance abuse, as well as corrections of you participated or led programs that have helped lower recidivism to below 30% over a period of 18 months. Why do you think it is hard for people to see drug addiction as a health issue as opposed to a law enforcement issue?
Well, I touched upon it already. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem, this is the bottom line problem in the United States now, is that as you and I are sitting here, 70% of all the prisons are filled with individuals that have something to do with the war on drugs. 70%.
Okay.
70% of every court action going on in the United States of America has something to do with the drug of war. Okay? 70%. That means 70% of all attorneys, 70% of all judges, 70% of all court clerks are all supported, take money home to feed their families off the war on drugs. You take the war on drugs, 70%, out of the judicial system, what do you have? Utter chaos.
Well, I would think you would have smaller government, because if you take away that 70%, as you said, then, you know, I think some people would be getting laid off, and perhaps they don't want to lose their jobs.
That's the point. Exactly the point. You're having 70% of some of the most brightest people, which are attorneys, okay, that 70% of them are out of a job, because 70% of those attorneys right now, as you and I are talking, support their entire practice. And I said this at the hemp harvest with a bunch of normal attorneys, and I said 70%, and they looked at me and said, no, James, it's 100%. So that's why that's the reason, the only way you can put a dent in the problems that we have right now is by people supporting the Native American church. That's it, because it's under the First Amendment, and nobody's going to mess with that First Amendment. The Native American church, Aklava, and specifically Aklava, because we are incorporated, we are based off of the Rosebud Reservation, which is an Indian reservation, that's who we are. But we are incorporated in the United States with no requirements placed upon us by race. In other words, I have an open arms policy that I will admit anybody into our church. We're on the reservations, the Native American churches are controlled by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which are controlled by influences, financial as well as churches, that have a great desire on suppressing the Native American church from receiving its constitutional rights. That's the reason the state of Utah attempted to outlaw the Native American church in an epic ruling that went to the Utah Supreme Court, where they tried to outlaw the Native American church. And the Chief Justice at that time, Chief Justice Duren, just during the hearing, the actual court hearing, said, "Is it true that we're trying to prosecute a church?" And my attorney says, "Yes." And it was downhill for them ever since. Therefore, the unanimous decision, which was a unanimous decision of a Supreme Court, stating, "What are you doing, Utah? Trying to outlaw a church?" Anytime this issue has come up into a higher court on whether the authenticity of the Native American church having the rights to utilize plants and herbs or cactus, peyote, whatever you want to call that, whether it's marijuana, it doesn't make really any difference, they always win unanimously. Unanimous decisions. The only way you can put a dent in this war on drugs and preventing people from being labeled as criminals is if they are members of the Oklava Native American Church, because all the other churches that are being practiced on reservations are closed down only to utilize or to be able to admit people that belong to their tribe. And so Oklava Native American Church is the only one that is incorporated that the United States government will accept as being an authentic Native American church that has these particular unique laws set up that you cannot prosecute us for the use of plants or cactus or peyote or ayahuasca. And that was decided upon on the United States Supreme Court.
Mr. Mooney, we do have to take a short break, but before I do that, where can people go online? Can they go on the internet and find out information about your church?
Yes, they can. It's very easy. And when you come back, I'll give the.
You can go ahead and give it now.
Well, the thing is, you go to Oklava. No. All you need to do is do nativeamericanchurch.org.net, and it'll come up to the website. And you'll be able to find out about us. And there is a segment there. If you come back, I will give you the exact address. But you go to nativeamericanchurch.net or .org, and you'll be able to see what it takes to be able to become a bona fide member of Oklahoma Native American Church.
Okay, well, you're listening to Black Talk Radio with Scotty Reed. It is Leap Day, and we're talking to James Flaming Eagle Mooney. We'll be right back after these messages, so don't go anywhere.
Pop quiz. Which is more dangerous, alcohol or marijuana? Study after study, the science shows that alcohol causes much more harm to the user and to society than marijuana. So why do colleges punish students more harshly for getting caught with cannabis? Join Students for Sensible Drug Policy and give your college administrators a simple pharmacology 101 lesson. Visit www.schoolsnotprisons.com to find out if there's a chapter at your school or how to start one.
Got any drugs or weapons on you?
No. I didn't do nothing.
You think you're tough? You think you're tough, huh? Scared now.
I like that. That's why I took this job. I hate no motherfuckers like you. Little nigga swing shit. Think you're tough, huh? Blow your head off this voice and you can do shit. How you feel now? What set you from? Look like one of them. Crenshaw Mafia, mother. No, you probably one of them rolling 60s, huh? Huh?
Call at 63, we have a possible 187. You can go BW by 404 in the morning. Again, a possible 187. have reasonable suspicion to believe you're involved in a crime, they're legally allowed to detain you for a short period of time. Reasonable suspicion requires less evidence than probable cause, but it basically means the officer has some specific reason to believe that you're up to something. For example, police can legally stop someone who matches the description of a criminal suspect, a suspect who drops a suspicious object after seeing the police, or someone who runs away after seeing the police. Don't ever run from the police. That's part of what the officers can use for probable cause. And they'll run you down and make you regret it. But if you see police approaching, be calm and assert your rights if need be. But don't run.
All right, and we're back. We thank you for staying with us. Again, my guest tonight is Mr. James Flaming Eagle Mooney, who is a former undercover narcotics officer. And before the break, you were, you know, talking about the Oklava Native American Church, and we will place a link in the program description for those listening to this podcast later, but you wanted to give out some other information. Please go ahead.
Okay, I'm looking it up for you right now. And I'll give you the exact address that will take you directly to the information or where you can actually find find information on. Okay, here's the address. The address is www.nativeamericanchurches.org. / AP card, and that's APCARD. That will take you directly to the site where a person could possibly become a member of the church. Okay?
Okay, that's great, and we certainly encourage our listeners to definitely check out that website, which will be linked up for you in the program description. And, again, talking about the impact on families, what do you think? Because some people say the ends justify the means. I was listening to you earlier, James, where you were talking about people feeling guilty or, no, when you were talking about working as an undercover officer or a drug informant, that your whole life is a lie. But some people would say the ends justify the means. So let me just ask you this question. What do you think does more damage to families? To incarcerate individuals, separating them from their families for long periods of time, or do the drugs themselves do more damage?
Well, Leach's position, which I agree totally, is that drug addiction is a medical problem. It's not a criminal problem. I mean, my gosh, you break a leg, do you get thrown in jail because you got a broken leg? Okay, do you get thrown in jail because you got cancer? I mean, a drug addiction is a disease, for goodness sakes. I mean, alcoholism is looked upon as a disease. So is every other addiction is looked upon as a disease. And so when you incarcerate a person because they're sick, I mean, you're developing another. You're compounding the problem. You have a disease that is difficult enough to be able to resolve. But then when you throw in a criminal aspect on top of it, and with our recidivism rate that it is set right now, it's 90%. You're making an issue that's dang near impossible to resolve. So I don't know if I've answered your question there, but I'm just saying to you the war on drugs is just detrimental on every aspect of it. It's preventing us. I mean, it's getting better where they're starting to have these drug courts and et cetera. But the real issue isn't the people that are sick. The real issue is the flipping laws.
I was reading an article earlier today, James, again, about these possible 12,000 inmates that are going to get out of prison because of the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010. Therefore, their sentences, which average 13 years, have been reduced. So you got about 12,000 people that's looking to get out of prison. And I read a comment from one of the officials. I can't remember his name, so I'm not going to try to recall his name right now. But this official, he said that, you know, he basically looked at these 12,000 people who were like crack cocaine violations, saying that, you know, they'll be right back. They're going to come right back to prison, and all we're doing is just letting people go who are going to commit future crimes. And if we wanted to save ourselves the trouble of these future crimes, we should just keep them locked up. I know you don't agree with that position, but if you could say anything to a person who holds that type of view, what would you say to them about this?
Well, I would first say I would talk to the communities in which these men and women would be released to. I would talk to their families. I would talk to their churches. And so that when these people get out of prison, that that the communities embraces these people, embraces them. And if they have substance abuse challenges, then you immediately get into programs that will be effective. And that's what's really, that's another sad thing about our community. The substance abuse programs that are out there now, okay, their success ratio is less than 10%. I mean, you have some places that you have, you spend $40,000 a month to get into. $40,000 a month, and their success ratio is less than 10%. So, and so you have to really look closely of what programs really do work. And I can tell you the kind of programs that actually work, such as the Salvation Army, which is no longer can practice in the state of Utah. This is another thing that you're dealing with. I told you about doing a program that we dropped recidivism within 18 months to less than 30%.
Yeah. Oh, the last shot program.
That's exactly right. Okay. Well, one of the people that came into that were co-workers in the prison system that had another program, which had absolutely no good results, came in to me and said, James, I understand you got some good numbers. And I said, I do. And he said, how did you do that? And I told him. And he said, can I take these numbers with me? I said, sure. So he takes these numbers, goes to the state of Utah legislators, and presents my numbers as his for his program. He gets $2 million to continue his program, and guess what program they canceled?
Yours, the Last Shot program.
That's right.
That's fraud. That's fraudulent, isn't it?
No.
Wow.
That's just simply a naive guy such as myself at that time that didn't realize what I was giving away to him. And instead of me going to the legislatures and getting $2 million for my program, that was just stupidity on my part.
Well, but it was also dishonest on his part to present information as being his when it wasn't, for a program that wasn't nowhere close to realizing the success that you were having. So you live and you learn. But what I would want to know if you would agree with this, though, James. When I hear about these people talk about a prison revolving door, and, you know, I've been following this issue for a number of years now, and I've always said the biggest thing that causes the revolving door is that when felons are released, is they are slapped with this label of being a felon. Their rights are taken away from them in many cases. It is a way. Michelle Alexander just wrote a book about the new Jim Crow. You know, it prevents these people from getting certain federal loans to, let's say, continue their education. It allows employers to legally discriminate against them. And so I believe that that's the biggest reason for the revolving door. Whether a person is reformed or not, we make it hard for them to reintegrate back into society, and so then they end up only having the illegal drug market as a way to support themselves, as a means to get income. And I believe it is purposely set up that way, James.
Right on. That's exactly it. That's the reason I stated right before when you're talking about these people that are probably going to be released. What was my first statement? That the community in which they're going into receives them with open arms. That will be the solution. The biggest solution is preventive medicine, and that is to eliminate the frickin' war that's causing this problem.
Right. I certainly agree with that. I know earlier I got a message because I subscribe to a bunch of different sources for information, and the Justice Department just released something from the Centers for Disease Control, and it was a video talking from a conference they had back in June where they were talking about, well, how do we keep young people from joining gangs? How do we keep our children from being a part of this violent subculture that exists in America? And then it talked about, you know, different organizations in the community working together through collaboration to come up with these programs. And I thought to myself, James, okay, if you want to eliminate these violent community, or if you want to make them seem less appealing, that the best way to do that is to take away their motive. And as far as I can see, the primary motive of a drug gang is drug profits. And by legalizing, taxing, and regulating, then, you know, there's no reason for these drug gangs to exist.
You're absolutely right again. I believe Ken Burns just had this incredible documentary on prohibition, and he wasn't talking about marijuana or today's drugs, but he's talking about prohibition of alcohol, and the same situation that happened in the 20s that's what's happening now, okay, or in 30s or whatever it was, and it's the same principle, same dialogue, same story, the whole thing. That is what funds our criminal program right now, and LEAP is totally on that. And we are talking with everybody that will listen to us to say, and I want to say this again, or no, I haven't said this. The reason LEAP is being so successful is because they're going about it in a mature manner. They're having discussions. They're educating people. And they're educating them on all levels that you and I have already talked about. But we're coming from a position of knowledge. We know firsthand experiences. This is what's being done. The corruption of our government. I didn't even tell you this. This was another reason that I decided that this was it. And this was really it. And all these two things that I described to you before, but this other one, they all happened all within a very short period of time. I was working on a particular bus that was going to take down the major transportation of all drugs on the western United States, okay? And it was centered in Washington County in the state of Utah. Well, we were ready to bust this place, And I had a meeting with Kim, and Kim got out of his car. I was there at the first this time. And when he got out of his car, I knew there was something wrong. And he came up to me, and I could tell he was just angry. He was fuming. And I said, "What's the problem, man?" And he said to me, "It's off." I said, "What are you talking? It's off." He says, "This thing we've been working on for 7 months." I said, "What are you talking about? It's off. We got them. It's perfect," I said. I mean, I was getting ticked. And he says, "It's off." And I thought, "What do you mean? How can it be off?" And he says, "One of the county commissioners, this is their pet project. We can't touch it." That was it for me.
I don't think I understand. What was the county commissioner's pet project?
the distribution of drugs from this particular place.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. that ended it for me. That with all the other two things that happened, or the other two things, and that was the final straw. I said, what I've been doing in all reality is taking out these little guys so this other guy didn't have any competition.
Well, I mean, that's evidence right there of what a lot of people say, that this drug war only really looks to target, you know, the low-level street dealer, while, you know, the people at the very top, you know, they usually, if they face any penalties at all, is they will get a slap on the wrist. You know, for example, I live in North Carolina. It came out early last year that Wachovia had agreed to a settlement with the Justice Department where they weren't going, no one was going to go to jail, and they don't have to admit guilt, but they pay, you know, this huge fine of $170 million, I believe it was, on about $1 billion that had been laundered, drug money that had been laundered, the banks had laundered through Mexican currency exchange houses. And I just couldn't believe that. Not one person is going to jail. You're talking about $1 billion, and so all Wachovia needs to do, executives need to do, is give up a portion of that profit, and then, you know, nobody else goes to jail. And so, you know, it you're exactly right, and I'm glad, you know, that you pointed out that, you know, they're targeting the little guy, and they're not putting I don't think the drug war is really designed to put an end to it at all, or put an end to the availability of drugs.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely.
Well, James, we come to the end of the program. It's certainly been a very informative time with you. Every time I have a guest on and we do a program, I like to give my guest the last word of the day to leave with our listeners, whatever you want to leave with them, the last word or the last thought about the drug war. So please,
the most important thing that I can express to your listeners is honor and respect our judicial process, and be involved in the political process. We have a president right now that within the first month of his presidency, he announced publicly that Wall Street is a culture of corruption. And then shortly after, he said, we have Washington, D.C. is also a culture of corruption. Right now, we have a culture of corruption. And by being angry, by being, we're going to get those guys, you know, not that, you know, do it like what LEAP is doing. Stand up for who you are and forgive these people that are earning so much money and perpetuating these things, and just start educating yourself, get politically involved, and speaking your heart. But do it in a responsible manner, not from anger. Come from a position of knowledge and forgiveness, and that these people are our brothers and sisters. Everybody are our brothers and sisters, and teach to be respectful to other people's differences. That's really what needs to be done, because people like LEAP and all these other people, they are really spreading the word, but they're doing it in a very mature manner. They're not doing it from anger. They're not doing it from a hurt position. They're doing it because they know it is right. It is right. The Constitution of the United States was hanging by a thread. But now, if you build off the First Amendment, because that's where your protection can come from, they cannot raid a church. They cannot. Constitutionally, they cannot. Unless they can prove a compelling interest, prove that the church is meeting a compelling interest. And that compelling interest is like you're building a bomb, and you have an intent, because it's not against the law to build a bomb on your property, but it is against the law to have the intent to blow up something off of that. That's a compelling interest. And having people partaking of an herb such as marijuana, which is proven to be of health for people that is medicine doesn't even begin to meet a compelling interest standard. So get people to honor that First Amendment. That's really where the pen can pluck and blow and take this balloon of indiscriminate constitutional violations away, is by supporting that First Amendment. But in order to do that, you've got to be legitimate, not angry. You have got to be passionate, but not angry, and respect and honor other people's for who they are and the differences. Respect the law enforcement people that are conducting doing their job, because in order to change it, they got to change it legislatively.
I understand. James Flaming Eagle Mooney, thank you for speaking with Black Talk Radio today.
It's been an honor, a true honor. Thank you very much.
It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Y'all know what tonight is? Tonight is Leap Night, or I sometimes call it Leap Day. But what that means is that on Wednesdays, we speak to a representative from law enforcement against prohibition. And tonight we will be talking to Mr. James Mooney. He has been on the program before. If you're a regular follower of this program, then you will know that, and y'all have to excuse my linguistic or my lack of linguistic skills, but I believe the name of the church is Aklavuwea Native American Church. He is the co-founder of that church. And he has several roles through which he attempts to correct some of the damage the war on drugs has perpetrated upon American families. And that's what he's going to come on the program and talk to us tonight about, is the impact of the drug war on families. The drug war propaganda has been going on for quite some time, especially when I was in high school. That's when Nancy Reagan, you know, came up with the whole Just Say No campaign. And there was some debate about whether or not that program is effective. I can't tell you if that program even still exists today in our high schools, or whether or not they have some other form of drug education. And so anyway, most of the drug war propaganda has said that drugs, you know, destroy family. And let's keep it real. We know that when people do abuse substances, that it can lead to the family falling apart, especially, you know, someone that's on some hard drugs and is taking all their money and stuff. And we've talked about, you know, how the drug war actually helps fuel that, you know, by creating this illegal drug market, and without it being controlled, without it being regulated by the state government or the federal government, that it's just really giving access to giving a lot of people that don't need access to drugs easy access, because all they got to do, is go find a street dealer. And unfortunately, they're not that hard to find, and I don't care what part of America you live in. I know a lot we focus on the black community, and we focus on what we call impoverished communities. Certainly, the drug market is thriving there, but the drug, you can get drugs from any community. They're in your gated communities. They're in the trailer parks. They're everywhere. They're in suburbia. You know, I was looking at the news. I think this was a story last year about this NASCAR driver. I can't recall his name, but he got busted for drugs. I think it was something like crystal meth or some pills or something, but he's still facing charges for that. I don't think he's had a trial yet. At least I haven't heard anything about it. But then also in this real, what they might call affluent area, I think it was the Lake Norman area. It might have been Lake Wiley, but you can imagine, you know, the value of the property if it's sitting on a lake. and they busted a big marijuana ring in one of those houses. So drugs is everywhere. It's just not, you know, limited to the urban areas. And so, you know, with drugs permeating our culture and our communities like that, the best thing that I feel like we can do to get a handle on the situation is to legalize, regulate, and tax. Because if we tax it, then at least we'll have money to provide for treatment, you know, treatment clinics. And that has really shown to be a good policy in a number of countries that have decriminalized drugs. You know, they had a considerable amount of people go and get some help and get off of drugs because they are no longer afraid of a criminal repercussions. And so therefore they come out the shadows and they get the help that they need, you know, sort of similar. I mean, nobody's today really ashamed to admit that they might have an alcohol problem, you know, and they'll go get some help. But a lot of people don't want to admit they may be a crack addict, they may be a heroin addict, and, you know, or other drugs. They may be hooked on ecstasy. It's just certain stigmas that are attached to certain drugs that people aren't that likely to come out of the shadows and seek the help because they don't want nobody to know. You know, they don't want anybody to know anything. And unless you got a lot of money like these celebrities, Hollywood celebrities, then it's hard for you, you know, to go to an exclusive treatment facility where you'll have that privacy. And so, you know, it's just a lot of things. And that's why I feel like it's important that we get together at least once a week on this program and discuss the drug war. So once again, we will be joined by James Mooney coming to us via Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Definitely check out their website. It is leap.cc, or you can, if this is easier to remember, copssaylegalizeddrugs.com. Great website, lots of information that people should consider before they make up their minds one way or the other when we're talking about the drug war. Now, before we bring James on, as I stated on my Facebook status message right before I came on air, I got some breaking news on the drug war, you know, because usually I like to, you know, just Google drug war and go to the news section of Google and see what the latest news is before I, you know, come on the program and do, you know, the ending the drug war segment. And check this out. Is Obama quietly changing his official position on the drug war? And I definitely got to get James's opinion on this. But let me read this to you. It comes to you from OttawaCitizens.com. And let me see, I may be mistaken. This could be Canada. Yeah, it is Canada. But I was thinking it was Britain, but it's actually Canada. When I saw the word Tories, I usually associate that with a legal party in Britain, but it's actually Canada. But let me read this to you. A high-profile group of current and former U.S. law enforcement officials have written to the conservative government with a surprising message. Take it from us. The war on drugs has been a costly failure. The officials are urging Canada to reconsider mandatory minimum sentences for minor marijuana offenses under its Tough on Crime bill and say a better approach would be to legalize marijuana under a policy of taxation and regulation. Now, I want to know, who are these current U.S. law enforcement officials? Again, you know, most of the guys that come to us through Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, they're all retired or working in another career and are no longer, you know, working in that area actively in the justice system prosecuting drug war cases. And so let me continue to read. Maybe they'll tell us who this law enforcement official is. We are extremely concerned that Canada is implementing mandatory minimum sentencing legislation for minor marijuana-related offenses similar to those that have been such costly failures in the United States, their letter reads. These policies have bankrupted state budgets as limited tax dollars paid to imprison nonviolent drug offenders at record rates instead of programs that can actually improve community safety. The letter was signed by more than two dozen current and former judges, police officers, special agents, drug investigators, and other members of the advocacy group Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Okay, so, you know, we talk to somebody from there every Wednesday, once a week at least, and we've had Mr. Neil Franklin on, who is the executive director of LEAP. He's been on this program a number of times. But I want to know, who are these current officials? Because certainly they may be putting their jobs at risk, and which they should be commended for that, because, they're standing on the truth. They have science on their side. They have the data on their side. And in these times of talking about cutting the budget, we could save a whole lot of money if we would just quit locking up people for nonviolent so-called drug offenses, you know. So, but the release of the letter comes just days after four former attorney generals in British Columbia called for the repeal of Canada's marijuana prohibition laws, saying they had done nothing but fuel organized crime and gang violence. However, the conservative government remains unswayed. In a statement, a spokeswoman for Justice Minister Rob Nicholson said the government had no intention to decriminalize or legalize marijuana and remains committed to ensuring criminals are held fully accountable for their actions. And let me see if it tells us. I don't want to read the whole article, but I want to know. I got to go to LEAP and find out who it is that has signed this letter. Maybe if I go to leap.cc, I can see a copy of this letter. I'm just interested to know who are the current officials that have signed this. Let me see if that's on their website. Okay, here it is. Let's see if they got anybody's name on here. Let me go through there. Among the 28 signers of the letter are many law enforcement officials working in border areas. They pointed to the illegal cross-border marijuana trade as sustaining gang activity in the region. Organized crime groups move marijuana to the U.S. from British Columbia and return with cocaine and guns, said Stamper. Prohibition continues to fill the coffers of organized criminals, making communities on both sides of the border less safe. Eric Sterling, who helped the U.S. Congress write the federal mandatory minimum sentencing laws, cautions as counsel to the U.S. House Judiciary Committee during the 1980s, I played a major role in writing the mandatory minimum drug sentencing laws, which later turned out to not only be ineffective in reducing drug use, but which directly contributed to the disastrous over-incarceration problem in this country. I urge policymakers in Canada to learn from our mistakes. Let me see, for a copy of the letter, okay, let me just pull up this PDF file, and I just want to know some names of some current people. Let's see, Stephen Downing, he's been on the program, he's retired. Former, I'm just trying to find who are the people who are currently working. Current Assistant Attorney General, State of Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, Jay Fisher. So he's still working in law enforcement. Let's see, Corrections Official, Shelley Fox Lucan. She's retired. Former Nate Bradley. Okay, this guy appears to still be in the military. Sergeant John C. Darker, a military police officer, United States Air Force. Do we got any more? I see a lot of familiar names of people who's actually been on this program before. And let's see. So it looks like it's just too current. Because I was going to say, you know, you're putting your career at risk. And while I wish more of you would do it, It's just surprising to me whenever a current law enforcement official comes out and stands on the truth, and not just truth on justice. It ain't just to be locking up people for a natural plant. Where's the justice in that? Okay, something that can, a weed literally is classified as a weed. I guess that's where it got its name from, a weed that can grow anywhere. You don't have to put add any additives to it or anything like that, and it has medicinal benefits. And locking people up for possession or something like that, that is ridiculous. Okay? So I'll get into that with James once we connect with him. I'm going to hit him up on Skype in just a moment. But we are going to focus on how the drug war destroys the family. So, I mean, that's some big news right there, you know, for one of the persons who authored the current drug laws to say that it was a mistake. A guy from the Reagan administration is saying that it's a mistake. And there are people from both sides of the issue, I mean, both sides of the aisle, liberal and conservative, who feel like, you know, the drug war is a failure. I mean, how can you argue with the facts? You have to be a lying politician, and I don't mean to, you know, make light of anything, but you have to be a lying politician to ignore the facts. You have to be a Newt Gingrich who stands by his comments back in the day that he wanted to execute anyone caught into this country or had anything to do with drug trafficking of 1 ounce, just 1 ounce of marijuana. That's crazy. That's crazy. Which reminds me, we did a program last night talking about, what were we discussing last night? The Stop and Frisk program in New York. We had a couple of people on the program. One of them was an attorney, and he left me a message. He wanted to correct some information that he gave out. And so let me just read that. And this is from Brother Manai Tafari. And he said, first, let me thank you for giving us an opportunity to spread the message of stopping mass incarceration. This is the biggest problem facing the black community. I agree with your point that what we need is to teach our people their rights on a mass scale. These rights came from God, not man. Slight correction to what I said last night regarding herbs in NYC, marijuana, that is. He said, as of 1977, less than 25 grams of marijuana in New York is not criminal, only a fine of $100. As long as it is not in public view, that means you cannot have a joint or even a roach in public view. Smoking a joint in public is a misdemeanor. Having a half ounce in your pocket is a $100 fine. And so he just wanted to correct that information. Okay, and check out last night's program. It was a great program with him and another gentleman. I can't recall his name right off the top. Noche, that was his first name, Noche. And it was a great program. I'm going to go ahead and take a break and so I can hit up James on Skype and get him connected to the program. I got somebody on 435. I'm not sure. He may have called in. 435, who do we have on the line?
And that's me. That's James.
Okay. I was just about to hit you up on Skype. I was just sharing some drug war news that I'm going to also share with you because this is breaking news in the organization Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, again, is at the forefront of fighting the drug war. But James, let me welcome you back to the program. It's good to speak to you again, sir. And for those who didn't catch the prior programs that you were on, can you tell them a little bit about yourself, about LEAP, and excuse my lack of linguistic skills, but your church as well, Akla Vaweva Native American Church. Please forgive me, but correct me. Hello, James? Okay, let me go ahead and hit him up on Skype. Maybe he's waiting on me to call him on Skype. Let me go ahead and get connected to him. Please stay with us. We will be right back.
We're going to simulcast this all over the globe at the same time. Rico. If you're overseas, whatever you're doing, you know what I mean? Big Pun, it's so hard. You know what I mean? We love you, Pun. We'll never forget. Never forget.
Hey, Scotty.
All right, we are back. We have James on the line. James, I'm not sure if you heard me prior, but I was just saying, if you could tell everyone who may not have heard you on a prior show a little bit about yourself, a little bit about Leap, and a little bit about the church you helped co-found.
Well, Scotty, I'd be honored to. I want to thank you again for having me on your show. Last time we were together, it was just a very memorable time, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing. Getting to Leap, that is really an organization that is doing something to end this incredibly detrimental war, not only to the people of the United States, but throughout the world. I mean, it's an obnoxious war that's based actually on a cultural war against the indigenous people of the United, not the United States, but of the entire world. And I'll get into that too a little bit. But LEAP is an organization of, I'm sitting here right now, of over 40,000 law enforcement officials, some that are still working in law enforcement, but a lot of them that are retired, such as myself. I was a undercover agent and worked for a prison system for more than about 12 years altogether. And I found myself when I joined the war on drugs as a undercover agent, I thought I was doing something good for my community. That's the reason I did it. Now I have to say that almost every one of my compadres, as we were working, we were thinking that we're doing something for our culture. But then there were about three or four different incidences we realized, holy mackerel, we're actually a part of the problem of this war on drugs. And so after that, when I realized how detrimental my work was, I actually went to work in the prison system and developed a habilitative program that developed incredible amount of success in lowering recidivism. And as soon as I lowered that, or the program that I developed to lower that recidivism, they canceled it. It's just
wow.
The system is so corrupt. It is just, it's mind-boggling when you really think about it. And so LEAP is a group of people that have the same testimony to the illegalities, to the immoral aspects of this war on drugs. And so what that's LEAP. And mind you, it's 40,000 law enforcement officials, judges, state and federal legislators, prosecuting attorneys, DEA agents, chief of police of states are doing everything in the world to get this war on drugs out of the human condition totally. And we will go anywhere to talk, such as we're doing right now, to spread the word. We feel that knowledge is power. Therefore, that's what we're doing. We're educating people. We have people that are working with governments, such as Canadian governments, in assisting them on not making the same mistakes as the United States has. And so you have a group of people that are just dedicated to end this war on drugs, because it's just immoral, it's illegal, it's unconstitutional, it's just a blight on the human consciousness of the history of mankind, as a matter of fact.
James, I think I'm not sure if it was you who said this, but it stuck in my mind. It may have been one of the other persons from LEAP, but it's not a war on drugs, although that is the commonly used phrase. But it's a war on people, actually. I'm like, you know, like Ron Paul, who says, how can you have a war on terror? How can you? Because that's a tactic. Terror is a tactic. That's not a, you can't have a war on a tactic. But I feel the same way about drugs. How can you have a war on a plant? You know, how can you have a war on you know, a product? How can you can't. It's actually a war on people, in my opinion, and somebody said that, and it kind of stuck with me.
Well, I may have been that person, because I personally believe it's actually a war on the indigenous people, the indigenous cultures of this world. You take a look at, let's take peyote. As you know, I'm also the co-founder of Oklava Native American Church, the only Native American church practicing off of Indian reservations that is recognized by the United States government as a Native American church. Now, one of the reasons that, the Native American church was formulated was because in 1876, now this is 1876, Congress passed a law, and it was signed into law by then President Grant, that the Native American culture is an earth-based healing spiritual religion. And that was under the Dawes Act related to the Rosebud Reservation, and this was in 1876. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs didn't have the stranglehold of the Constitution in dealing with the Native American culture that was captured and placed in what we call prisons, which we call now reservations. And what happened is they were actually literally murdering the medicine people to kill out the ceremonies, to kill your culture. Right, because we carried our culture through our ceremonies, and the medicine people were the ones that conducted the ceremonies. So they started murdering them. And the last time they murdered known, it was with the Crazy Horse. They murdered him because he would not sign the agreement to capitulate to the principles that the Bureau of Indian Affairs was putting onto the reservation. And then after they killed him, then they killed Sitting Bull because he wouldn't do it either. And then right after that, almost within a month of itself, then you had Wounded Knee Massacre, which was in 1890, December the 30th. And that was the last time that the Bureau of Indian Affairs would actually utilizing the government, lying to the government army, and murdered over 300 to 400 people. And then later on, and that reached the consciousness of the public of the United States, and so they stopped the killing, the outright killing of it. But then they started outlawing and putting them into prison, Native American medicine person or anybody that would be practicing their sacred ceremonies. And so in 1918, because they couldn't get it stopped and there was so much fighting going on between the medicine people and the puppet Indian governments, that they went to the United States Congress and to write a law, and brought up the law in 1918 to outlaw the entire American Native culture. Wow. And at this particular time, my grandfather, great-grandfather, James Mooney, who I happen to be named after, stood up in Congress and argued for the Native American culture, saying it would be terrible and you can't do that. You cannot outlaw a culture. And the movement was so fast and so strong when it was in the House of Representatives, they actually voted to continue and pass it on to the Senate. But in the Senate, they took my great-grandfather's message and brought it up into the Senate, read it in the Senate, and they killed the bill. Now, at the same time, my great-grandfather, right after they killed the bill, he went to the Native American spiritual leaders in Oklahoma and said, the Bureau of Indian Affairs is not going to give up. They're not going to give up. And the only way you can preserve your culture is to incorporate your culture under the name of Native American Church, so that then it will be protected under the First Amendment. And so they incorporated it under the First Amendment. Then the Bureau of Indian Affairs
started a campaign. I mean, they were really upset. They were so upset that they went to the Smithsonian Institute, in which my great-grandfather worked, and got him fired. Okay, I mean, and so then the campaign from then on at least stopped the murdering and killing of people that were practicing the Native American spirituality. And remember, the whole law that they tried to outlaw the Native American or outlaw the culture was pinpointed on peyote. That's what they were doing. Now, this is something very, very interesting, and your readers need to really understand this, or your listeners. This is what Harvard affiliate McLean Hospital, under a long-term study of about what peyote is and what it does. And I want you to think about it. Peyote is an entheogen. And you want to know the definition of an entheogen?
Please.
An entheogen is a chemical substance, typically of a plant origin, that is ingested to produce a non-ordinary state of consciousness for religious or spiritual purposes. The Greek term for it is becoming divine within.
Wow.
And they wanted to outlaw that.
Hmm. Wow.
So when you really get down to it, the war on drugs is actually a war on the indigenous people from becoming more connected with God.
You know, just listening to you cite the history of the Native American people here in the United States, and with me coming from the black community and studying our history since we were brought here to these shores and chains, I see similar patterns here of because, you know, Africans, enslaved Africans, when they were brought here, were stripped of their culture as well. They were forbidden from practicing, you know, the religious traditions that they brought with them, and they were forced to adopt Christianity, which is another thing that has also been forced on Native American people. Actually, my great-great-grandmother is a North Carolina Cherokee Indian, and that's one of the things that they did, you know. So it doesn't amaze me, it doesn't surprise me, but it just confirms things that I already know about the pattern and practices of the United States government in attacking non-white people, I should say.
It's actually right. And this is becoming extremely evident. I mean, people have tried to blind other people to think it's something about we're trying to protect the culture from these horrible drugs. I mean, things like the what was it called? Marijuana Madness, or the movies that they made out.
Reefer Madness.
Yeah, I mean, that is so much nonsense. It's incredible. And so that's another thing. Now, let's take cannabis, for instance. There's Indian tribes all over North and South America that actually have been worshiping with cannabis from they don't know how long. And Tuscarora. The Tuscarora tribe of the East Coast. Do you know what the meaning of Tuscarora is?
No, I don't.
Hemp harvesters.
Hmm.
I mean, it is the entire war on drugs was initiated to block out, to stymie, to eliminate the indigenous people of the world.
Now, James, one of the things we should point out about hemp is that hemp is an industrial plant as well. We're not talking about the marijuana that, you know, people smoke. There is also, you know, industrial hemp that doesn't carry, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't have THC, or it doesn't have as high levels of THC, which is the chemical component of marijuana, what helps people get to another state of consciousness. But to me, by them banning or outlawing hemp, that was purely for economic reasons.
That is exactly right. You see, you're hitting upon two different elements here. There's two elements that wanted to outlaw the American Native culture in the United States. In all reality, it is a worldwide, they want to eliminate the entire indigenous culture and belief for two major reasons, in my opinion. And I'll tell you what they are. The first group is influential religious zealots, especially religious zealots that want you to maintain your relationship with their religion because they're the ones that have the answer, that they, you have to go through them that will qualify you to get to heaven. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to name those particular religions, but there's a couple of them.
I think my listeners got a pretty good idea as we talk about this. We just did a program earlier this week on that, but please continue.
Okay. The second one are greed-laden opportunists that have influence on the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And those two, the zealots and the greed-laden opportunists, are the ones that have all the influence on the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And the reason for the zealots is what I just got through telling, but the greed-laden opportunists, this is the real catch-all.
Mm-hmm.
Remember what I said. In 1867, President Grant signed into law that the Native American culture is an earth-based healing religion.
Mm-hmm.
So now, when it was incorporated, they had control over it when it was just on the reservations, which were considered and still are sovereign nations. So they don't fall under the First Amendment. So when the religion culture became incorporated as a religion, as the Native American church, then it falls under the protection of the First Amendment.
Okay.
Now, what happens is now, because it's in the United States and protected under the First Amendment, it's an earth-based healing religion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when the Native American church can prove that mining uranium or digging oil wells is desecrating our temple?
Because it's an earth-based.
Got it. And so all we have to do is file a federal injunction, and it stops.
Good information. I'm surprised that some environmentalists haven't picked up on that. You know, not that I've heard of, but this is first time I've heard of that.
Well, it's what's so interesting is I have formulated, I founded the Native American Church, blessed by the Rosebud Reservation to become that and then incorporate it. And now, from what I understand, the United these particular influences upon the Bureau of Indian Affairs have done everything. They got your tax money, spent over $35 million trying to find something to discredit me.
Wow.
And they failed. They fail. And every time people challenge the authenticity of the Native American church and the authenticity of its spirituality and it being protected under the First Amendment, it happened once in 1990 where a white fellow was arrested for having peyote mailed to his home. His name was Robert Boyle. Look it up, Robert Boyle versus the United States of America. And he literally kicked their butts. They're trying to do this thing, saying that Native American spirituality is only for Native American people of tribal governments. That's like saying, in order to belong to the Roman Catholic Church, you have to be born in Italy, for God's sakes. I mean, that's what they pulled out.
That's racism. That's racism.
That's exactly right. That was successfully accomplished. Okay. because people believe the Native American church can only have Native American Indians that are working it. I mean, these people have been highly successful in brainwashing our entire culture that the Native American church does not deserve the same constitutional rights as the Catholic Church or the Mormon Church or the Baptist Church or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In order to belong to the Native American Church, they have brainwashed the courts, they have brainwashed the judges, they have brainwashed the attorneys and the United States public that unless you're a Native American person of a federally recognized tribe, you cannot worship in my church.
Now, actually, I want to let the listeners know because we, you know, we also streaming right now on Facebook and we're streaming on our network, Black Talk Radio Network, and there is a banner link to your church. And I have, again, I'm a country Southern boy, and I have I'm linguistically challenged. So pronounce the name of your church again that people can go and get that information.
It's Oklahoma. That's Oklehua Native American Church.
Oklahoma
Native American Church.
Okay. And we do have that linked up on blacktalkradionetwork.com. So if you're listening right now from the Black Talk Radio news page on the network, you can just look over to the right-hand side of the screen and you'll see a banner with their logo, and you can click on that, and it'll open up in a new window for you. And you were saying, so anybody can join your church, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I got to tell you, Scotty, now, this is going to put a smile on your face, Scotty. All right. In my traditions, I am a Seminole. And I don't know if you ever heard of it, but there is a group of people called Black Seminoles.
Yes, I've heard of them.
Okay, the Black Seminoles were escaped slaves that made it into the Florida Everglades. And the Seminole Indians, the Native American people of Florida it's a combination of Cree, Choctaw, Cherokee, a whole slew of people that migrated into Florida because it was owned by Spain and was protected from Andrew Jackson's onslaught of killing everybody. And so when the escaped slaves discovered that, they started to escape going into Florida. Then that was the cause of the first what they called Seminole War I, and that's when the Andrew Jackson sent his armies into Florida to try to recapture the slaves. And Indians and blacks, man, I'm telling you get them together, you're going to get your butt kicked, and that's exactly what happened. And so when they failed at that, then they had Seminole War III or Seminole War II, and that's when the plantation owners misused their lands and they weren't getting the yield in their crops. So they said, well, let's go over to Florida and take that land because it's still fresh. And that was Seminole War II. They got their butts kicked again. So then Spain ended up buying Florida, or excuse me, United States bought from Spain, Florida. And so then the United States went in there and said, okay, we want you out of here. However, we will pay you for you and move you to Oklahoma. Well, they didn't like that, especially my great-great-great-grandfather, who was named Osceola. He said, no way. And so he fought them out, and the particular tribe called Harjo Town stuck it out, and now they're known as the Unconquerable Seminoles, which is now the state of Florida University.
Mm.
Because
wow.
We never gave up. We never signed a peace treaty. And so we would call you a Black Seminole, and you'd be sitting in a place of honor in our circles.
Yeah, you did just put a smile on my face. But, again, I do have Native American ancestry. My great-great-grandmother right here in North Carolina, and of course you probably heard about how they moved, you know, the people off the land and
exactly.
On the Trail of Tears and everything, and my great-great-grandmother was one of the very few who got to stay on her land, and that land is still in our family today.
Yeah, she probably hid out because most of us had to. My grandparents, my direct descendants escaped off the Trail of Tears, someplace in southern Missouri, and if they were told, or if somebody found out that they were actual Seminoles, somebody would have cut their head off and got $200 gold pieces.
Yeah, she was Cherokee, but the reason, unfortunately, and I, you know, I can't say because I wasn't there, because I am talking about my great-great-grandfather, but he was from Scotland, and she married him, and under his protection, she was able to keep the land. And
there was something about Scottish people and Irish people. They seem to have some kind of comradeship with the indigenous people of this nation, and maybe it's because they were an earth-based group of people.
And they were oppressed by the British, so we have to remember that as well. So I do need to take a short break, take a station identification break, but do want to tell everyone we do appreciate. I see those who are in the chat room. If you have a question, you can enter it through the chat room, and I will ask that question, or you can call in to 347-826-9112. Again, that's 347-826-9112 for the individuals who may be listening either on our Facebook fan page or on the Black Talk Radio Network. We'll be right back. Our guest tonight is Mr. James Mooney. We are ending the drug war with law enforcement against prohibition. We'll be right back.
The other day I read
In the dictionary.
A definition of terrorism. It reads like this. The use of violence.
Or the threat of violence.
To accomplish a political end. The use of fear.
The threat of fear.
To accomplish a political end.
No one will dispute.
The stop and frisk.
Aims to make people afraid.
This is Ron Hayes with Hood News, and you're listening to the Black Talk Radio Network. Stay tuned.
And we're back. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News with Scotty Reed. We air Monday through Friday at 8 o'clock p.m. to 10 o'clock p.m. I guess I should go ahead and announce, especially for our Blog Talk Radio listeners, that this program, this evening program, let me cut this volume down. This evening program, we will be moving to a new platform. For those who know me and been following me a while, I run a new media nonprofit organization here in North Carolina, and we're going to partner with the good folks at New Vibe Radio to where we will be broadcasting our live program streaming on newviberadio.com as well as on blacktalkradionetwork.com. I'm not sure if we'll still be able to offer the stream on Facebook. I have to go into the lab and see what I can come up with to see if we can still offer the show on Facebook. But keep that in note. We are due to launch on that new platform on March 5th. That is March 5th. However, we will still maintain this Blog Talk Radio account, and I may start doing a, like, 20-minute news brief program in the morning and also giving you information on the upcoming live program that night. So just want to make that as a mental note. We are excited about it as it does present a great opportunity for both of our organizations, so we're happy to work with the good people at newviberadio.com. James, I read in the news today, there's a local radio host who loves to use that phrase. He does a little segment, I read in the news today. And I read in the news today, and we're going to get to how the drug war is destroying families. And one of the ways that it's destroying families is through violence, through gang violence, through the cartel violence. And something interesting happened today. I think it was today. I believe, let me look at the, it actually doesn't have a date, but I found it in the news section of Google today, and it says that Mexico the Mexican president made a plea to Texas and the United States of America, no more guns. I'm just going to read briefly from here. It says, Mexican President Felipe Calderon pleads with the United States to do something, anything to help stop the flow of guns from the United States to Mexico. But the way he came to the Texas-Mexico border recently and delivered his latest plea was especially attention-grabbing. With the media recording every moment, a Mexican army tank and a steamroller crushed about 6,000 seized guns and other weapons, the El Paso Times reported. Dear friends of the United States, Calderon said in English on the Mexican side of the Bridge of the Americas and within earshot of border commuters, Mexico needs your help in order to stop this terrible violence we are suffering. And the best way to do that is by stopping the flow of assault weapons into Mexico. Calderon often points out that if the United States wants Mexico to do its part to halt the flow of drugs north, the U.S. will have to do more to help Mexico stop the flow of guns from the United States. I think they're both lost causes, James, but what are your thoughts on it?
Well, my thoughts are just hopefully enlightening more than just depressing. I happened to watch a movie last night called Gangsters with Denzel Washington, and it was about the black kingpin that really became a very strong drug distributor of heroin in the 70s, and he was eventually brought down. But when he was actually captured, he ended up bringing down his compadres in his, I don't know how you would call it, but his crime syndicate. And with that, he brought down one third of the New York police force as well.
Frank Lucas.
Frank Lucas, exactly right. What a man. And the cop that took him down, but they ended up becoming friends. As a matter of fact, the police officer who took him down ended up becoming an attorney. And Frank Lucas was his first client that got him out of prison after 15 years. But anyway, I want to tell you this story because, well, the story will tell itself. This was the last project I worked on when I was undercover. And I had worked on it for about 6 months. And there was a community that was, I'm not going to tell you where the community is.
That's fine.
But I will tell you that it was an airport community. Okay. Well, we discovered that this was one of the biggest areas where a good portion, if not about 80% of the drugs that flowed into the what we call the Wasatch Mountain Range states, which includes Arizona, Utah, Colorado, and Idaho, and they were bringing it into this airport community. And I had worked on there, as I said, I was undercover, and we had them. I had everything we needed. And I'll never forget it, that my contact, because I was very deep. I had no one but one person that knew who I was, and that's probably why I was able to survive.
You were like Wesley Snipes, deep cover, right?
I was really deep cover. And my code name was Jimmy, as a matter of fact. And what I did... Anyway, we were meeting in our secret place. We only met about once a month, but because we're coming close to taking this whole community down, we had a meeting to formulate the last aspects of taking it down, making sure the warrants were written right, and et cetera. And I remember my contact getting out of the car, his pickup, and walking towards me, and I could tell there was something wrong. And he got to me,
within talking distance, and he looked at me, and he was pissed. And he said, it's off. And I said, what? And he says, it's off. I said, what are you talking about? It's off, James. What in the hell are you talking about? And he said, we can't take them down. And I said, well, what? I mean, I was livid. What are you talking about? We can't take them down. One of the commissioners that said on the county commission, it was his pet project.
What do you mean his pet project?
It was his business.
He was the drug dealer.
Got it.
I'm not surprised.
I spent 7 years taking down people so this guy could clean himself out from competition.
Wow.
Yeah. That's when I quit. And so did Kim. Excuse me. So did my contact.
Wow. And is that like rare, or you know, in your line of work, was it rare to come across officials? I mean, I've read all kind of stories, you know, and some people, they tend not to believe them because they start talking about, like, governors and stuff like that. And I'm not going to say some names, but I have read some stuff about some governors allowing cocaine trafficking to go on at airports and stuff that they knew about, and they protected it. But I've also heard about beat cops on the street, you know, dealing drugs, and they just had a case in New York where you had a couple of cops that was busted because they were trading drugs for sexual favors from addicts. Okay, these were New York City police departments, and I think that police department really needs to be really, really, really looked at by the Justice Department. But, I mean, let me put it like this. Neil Franklin, who's the executive director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, you know who that is, James. But I believe it was him. I've talked to so many of you guys. Sometimes I may attribute the statement to the wrong person. But the statement was made that the drug war corrupts law enforcement. And I imagine it corrupts our public officials as well. What would you say about that? Is that an accurate statement?
Absolutely.
And I read about that's what's going on in Mexico as well.
Absolutely. And you just, what did we talk about, Frank Lucas?
Mm-hmm.
Took down one third of the New York Police Department. One third.
Wow, that's
it
huge.
Absolutely corrupts our entire system, from judges to law enforcement undercover agents. It is the most detrimental policy the United States of America has perpetrated on not just the United States, but the entire world. And that is the reason you have 40,000 ex-law enforcement working and doing. Not only are they doing it because they know this is a corrupt war, a corrupt activity, corrupt policy that the United States has undertaken to make certain people rich, to suppress you were talking about earlier about cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I remember when I was in college, I remember a fellow did a paper and he called it the illegal war on marijuana is what he said. And the starting paper came out, or the first paragraph, first sentence, it said, Martha, I cannot wait until I get back home in time for the hemp harvest. Martha, being George Washington's wife. Because back in those days, when you had a great deal of property, it was the law that you planted cannabis at a certain percentage of your land so that you could make paper, so you could do cloth.
Right,
so you could make rope.
Right.
I mean, it's the most incredible plant that actually undermines the oil industry. Today, Brazil is making biofuel
out of corn and stuff.
Out of corn. And cannabis has a yield 1 to 10 of corn.
Mm-hmm. It's a weed, and it can grow just about anywhere.
It does grow anywhere, and you can have it harvested 3 to 4 times a year.
And so the real reason for cannabis being put in there, it's not addictive. You can't overdose on it. And that's what the drug laws were initially set up, is if you can overdose on them or if you if it's addictive. And neither one of them.
And there was some racism in that too, because
it's all racism.
Yeah, you mentioned reefer madness, and I've talked to people and I've read stories about, you know, propaganda being put out there that, you know, if we don't outlaw marijuana, then white women are going to be up in the jazz club with black jazz musicians smoking weed and getting wild.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The best one that I know of, okay, that it's the gateway to drugs. I mean, that argument, just think, well, then we better start outlawing oxygen because, man, every time we breathe, it makes us available so we can start smoking marijuana. I mean, that's the most idiotic argument I've ever heard. I mean, but that's the kind of malarkey that has been fed to the United States public and to the world so that they can suppress the Native American cultures that honor these plants so they can make billions of dollars in oil, make billions of dollars in the pharmaceutical industry by suppressing these herbs, when all you have to do is go pick something off of a leaf off of a plant, put it in your mouth, and all of a sudden you don't have any more pain. I mean, give me a break.
Right. It has medicinal benefits. It also has commercial benefits.
Right.
As you stated, you can make a wide range of products from hemp, paper. And that reminds me, you know, talking about the politics of it all and how the American public has been duped and still being duped is, I think his name is William Randolph Hearst, who was
he was the major one. He's the one that's developed the whole propaganda malarkey. He financed reefer madness, but because of his paper, and that's the reason he wanted to outlaw cannabis, because he acquired a great deal of forestry up in the northwest states, and he wanted to supply his string of papers throughout the United States and capitalize just on the wood. And so he developed a relationship with Du Bois, who was chemical, because cannabis makes the best paper in the world because it carries its own chemicals that breaks down the fibers. And so Du Bois, needing to sell his product of chemicals that will break down the fibers of wood,
mm-hmm.
so that it can become paper,
mm-hmm.
they banded themselves together to outlaw cannabis, to suppress what they thought was competition to their financial wealth.
And we thought today we had a problem with big money controlling politics. It's always been an issue. You know, I can't say going all the way back to, you know, when the United States was first founded, as far as, you know, these drug laws and stuff go. But I tell you, man, it's just very, very depressing. But at the same time, it is empowering us with knowledge so that then we can confront these politicians when they hold these town hall meetings, or we call them on the phone, or we write a letter, because we know what we're talking about and we know the history of this so-called war on drugs.
That's right. There's another thing too that's really quite interesting as far as I'm concerned. I spoke at the hemp harvest, and I was sitting down with Leaf. I had a couple speaking engagements with Leaf, and I was also asked to bless the entire hemp harvest as a medicine man, and I did that also. But during one of the social activities, I'm sitting around a table with about seven or ten lawyers, and we're talking, and I said something about, you know, as we're sitting here right now, 70% of the entire, this is the entire judicial system, 70% of everybody that's in prison today, and we are the number one country in the world that has people in prison. It's
mm-hmm.
one out of every 100 citizens, one person out of every 100 are in prison today. And now you have these private held prisons that are lobbying to have all kinds of laws like implemented. If you don't have your any identification, they can arrest you.
So yeah, I heard they were behind, partly behind the immigration bill down there in Arizona.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. That's what, and what it is to develop all these laws utilizing natural habits so that they can keep their blasted prison cells filled. They are right now, from what I understand, and I could be wrong, but right now the private prison system in the United States is the highest netting income, the highest grossing income businesses in the United States of America.
You know what, James? It is Black History Month, although I try to celebrate Black History 365 days out of the year. But, you know, I came across some troubling information, and I've said this on one of my prior programs, but others, you know, that's listening now or will listen to this podcast may not have heard that particular program. But I was very, very disappointed to hear that the son, I'm talking about the son of the first Black Supreme Court Justice, I'm talking about Thurgood Marshall, his son, Thurgood Marshall Jr., and you can look this up on the internet, people, but he sits on the board of one of the largest private prison corporations in the United States and possibly the world. That really
I could tell you what prison system that is, but I won't.
People can look it up. The name escapes me right now, but just Google his name, Thurgood Marshall Jr., people, and private prisons, and you'll be surprised what you. I was certainly surprised. I was like, how could you? Your father was out there, you know, fighting through the courts to get people freedom and rights, and now you are getting rich off of taking away people's freedom and rights. That just made me so angry, James.
Yeah, it just really is. But let me finish up on something.
Sure.
That hit Harvest. I'm talking about it. I said 70% of the entire judicial system is supported by the war on drugs. And so if you ended the war on drugs, you would eliminate 70% of all the judges, 70% of all the defense and prosecuting attorneys, all the court people that support the war on drugs, 70% of all the jails, 70% of all the prison systems if you ended the war on drugs. And these, you know what these attorneys said?
What?
The attorneys that are sitting around the table, they said, no, James, you're wrong. And I said, well, what do you mean? It's 100% with these people. 100% with defense attorneys.
Mm-hmm. Because so those are most of the cases that they take. Yeah, we just had a defense attorney on the other night.
Mm-hmm. It's corrupted our entire judicial system.
Well, James, I got a question, and it may be rhetorical in nature, but maybe you could answer it. I don't know. I'll just throw it out there for anybody to answer and welcome those new listeners that just came into the chat room. And if you got an answer for me, you can call 347-826-9112. But now, we know that there is a group out there called the Tea Party. Okay, and there is a branch of the Republican Party that's always talking about limited government, and we need to reduce the size of government, and we need to cut spending. Wow, man, what you just said sounds like the magic pill to me.
Absolutely.
Why we Absolutely. Can't? How do we get them on board?
You know, it is so ingrained. So many people's income that paying for their families and taking care of their families. I mean, if you ended the war on drugs like cold turkey, it would kill the entire economy of our country. I don't know what the answer is. Scotty, I wish I did. I think that one of the answers, to be frank with you, is people become members of the Oklahoma Native American Church. And so they can delineate all of the you can stop busting people that have those cards, and then it can kind of slowly set it about. I personally think becoming members of the Oklahoma Native American Church is a way to start eliminating the war on drugs. But it will be done in a way that won't...
you don't need the government, so to speak. You don't need to overturn laws, although that is the goal, is to get these laws off the book. But what you're saying, the way I understand it, that if I join the church and I have that card and then I got, you know, some marijuana on me and I get pulled over, that, you know, that by my religion and belonging to this church, then I won't face the same penalties that I would otherwise.
Well, what will happen, because people, because the law enforcement agencies really don't understand the power of that, of the Native American church, and so, but you'll have a legal stand on being able to stand up against them. But what they're doing right now to suppress that activity is utilizing a little principle that is so unethical, it's incredible, and that is called delay justice in hopes of denying justice. And what they're doing is that if you're stopped and you show them that your card, in reality, by the law, you have just put them on notice. And if they should molest you, then they're the ones. It's called violating your civil liberties. But because there's so much money being made by the counties and by the cities and by the states off this war on drugs, they're ignoring it. It's like if they're going to raid a Native American church, they don't tell the judge that they're going to raid a church. They avoid saying it, because if they do say that they're going to raid a church, they have to meet a compelling interest standard, mm-hmm. which is there's no way in the world for smoking marijuana they can even begin to meet that standard. Therefore, they wouldn't get the warrant. So what they do, and the judges are in cahoots with it, is that they don't tell them that it's a church, it's a private residency that is distributing drugs. And so then they sign them up, or they get their search warrant, and then they file that. Then they're in the system, and then the courts will refuse to have the person to argue under his First Amendment rights, because he wasn't busted for violating the church. I mean, it's just corrupt as hell. I don't know of any way to do it. But what happens if you get a stubborn person like me, like they raided our church. Here, they raided our church in Utah, and we're taking heroin addicts off the street. We're giving homes to mothers that had children that were deserted by their husbands. We're helping prisoners coming out of prison to get jobs and to overcome their substance abuse issues. And they raided our church, and then they put life sentences on both my wife and I. And then, but we appealed it, and appealed what we call applied for a dismissal of the charges, and the Fourth District Court refused to do it. Okay, but we appealed it to the Utah Supreme Court. It got to the Utah Supreme Court, and they said, "What the hell are you guys trying to do?" And unanimously, they ruled on for us. So what you have to do is, if you are arrested and you have a card, you do not plea bargain. If you plea bargain, you will lose. You ask for a public defender, and you tell them to file a motion to dismiss. And 9 times out of 10, they will not do it. They will not do it because they know it's bucking the whole system. And so then but if you belong to the Native American Church and we have enough members, then we will file it for you. But right now, we don't have enough members. We don't have enough cash flow coming in so we can go and fight these stupid battles. But the moment we have members, we're going to have the money, and I don't care who it is. Somebody gets, and they have a card, we'll be there for them. But right now we can't, because we just don't have enough money coming through. That's the reason I'm hoping, and LEAP is hoping, that people will understand, and there will be a campaign out there in the United States that will have volumes of people coming into our church so that we'll be able to fight these battles for these people. Because the whole system right now is corrupt. It is totally
corrupt. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I do need to take another station identification break. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News with Scotty Reed. My guest tonight is Mr. James Mooney, and he comes to us via Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Visit their website at leap.cc. If you're interested in finding out more information about the Native American Church, you can go to Black Talk Radio Network, and there is a link there. And the website is NativeAmericanChurches.org, NativeAmericanChurches.org. Again, if you're on Black Talk Radio Network right now listening to the program, just click on that link. And, James, when we come back on the other side of this break, let's talk about how the drug war is destroying families because, you know, talking propaganda again that has been put out there to get people to support, you know, the war on drugs is they say that, you know, drugs are destroying the family, you know, and so we'll talk about that on the other side of this break. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Russell Campbell, veteran of the Civil Rights Movement. Now, you're listening to Black Talk Radio, a radio station that reaches out to all the people of the United States that deal with black issues.
Instead of legislation, in my opinion, it takes education. The whites have to be re-educated so that the racism that they have in their heart can be eliminated, and the and our people have to be re-educated so that we will know how to do something for ourselves instead of waiting for others to do it for us all the time.
Well, how will that re-education be brought about?
Well, just as in World War II, this country could use its news media to propagandize and make the whole American public love the Germans and the Japanese, rather love the Russians and the Chinese and hate the Germans and the Japanese, and then after the war they changed it and made the American public love the Germans and love the Japanese, hate the Russians and hate the Chinese, which shows that they can make the American public love whom they will and hate whom they will. And that same process can be used to re-educate the American public and show white people how to love black people and show black people how to do something to stand on our own feet and solve our own problems.
All of a sudden we call out our names, bitches, et cetera, F you this, F you that. One of the young ladies who was yelling and screaming at them got drugged from the steps all the way down the steps and arrested. The other young lady, they beat her up. She passed out because she had an asthma attack. They left her there, and they left us there. No one called an ambulance for neither one of us. Three of us was arrested. One young man came running to see if I was all right. He got beat with nightsticks and arrested. None of these officers from the 75th, the 73rd, the 69th, or PSA 2 have been arrested.
When you see your child in a police car, and I know that... For me, I never really thought about it. But at that moment, that's your child. You know that's your child. But once them handcuffs go on, you have no say so over your child. And that was a hurting moment for me because it was nothing that I could do.
There'll only be one king.
And we are back. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News. And that news clip that you just heard is from our program the other night with members of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Let me restate that again. I was getting a campaign that they're working on confused with the actual network. And that is Stop Mass Incarceration Network, okay? Check our archives. Check some of our shows in the archives. You'll see that was a program we did last night, and they were out in the community interviewing victims of the New York City Police Department's Stop and Frisk program. Remember, they stopped over 500,000 people last year and frisked them. And those people were predominantly black people and Latino people, and what was more telling was that 87% of those people that they stopped weren't doing anything wrong and didn't even get so much as a ticket. And I feel like while they try to say that the Stop and Frisk program is part of trying to get guns off the street of New York, I know it in my heart that it is part of the drug war. And they just, in my opinion, murdered Ramali Graham, that 20-year-old young man for what? A bag of freaking weed. They took that young man's life. And you think his and killed him in his grandmother's house. Now, you think, you tell me the drug war is not having a negative impact on our families. How many of our fathers are locked up in prison? Okay? For nonviolent drug crimes, and you want to say, well, maybe they shouldn't have been selling drugs. Well, maybe if we had enough jobs in America, people wouldn't have to go out on the street and hustle to try to put food on the table and clothes on their back. That's just the reality of the situation. And we know that unemployment has always been traditionally higher in the black community than it has been in the non-black communities, like the white community. Okay? Our unemployment rate is always higher, all right? And but they got a job for you, all right, and it's on that prison plantation. And that's why I do this program every Wednesday and call it Stopping the Drug War, because it's destroying our families. And sorry I went on a rant there, James, but I get emotional sometimes about this issue, and I see the damage that it's doing to our families.
Well, I think I expressed this to you last time, Scotty, but I'll repeat myself. I was in a car. I had two people that were wired, two young people, inside of a home, and they were, we could hear everything that was being said inside. And suddenly, I heard this little boy cry out for his mother. And I knew I was going to take that mother and that father away for 10 years. And I said to myself, right there, it was like a shock. I mean, it was like somebody took a baseball bat and hit me right between my eyes and said, I said to myself, oh my gosh, I am part of the problem here. I'm not part of the solution. And that is exactly what I felt and what I feel now. And the thing is, the family is the unit that keeps our country together. And going back, one of the things that the Bureau of Indian Affairs wanted to do with the Native Americans was to break up the families. They took the children away from their family, put them in schools where they were taught to hate their culture.
Mm-hmm.
If they talked their own language, they got the pedidos kicked out of them. And so the whole thing was to break down. It was totally racial war. And that is what the drug on wars is all about. It's a racial war, and they start first by eroding the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that the whole war is eroding the family fabric. People have got to understand that addiction is not a legal problem. Addiction is a medical problem. Mm-hmm. And once we start dealing with the medical problem, I mean, that's hard enough to deal with. But then you put a criminal aspect on it. That's the reason we had 90% recidivism in our prison, because 70% that are in prison are there because of a medical problem. But we've got on top of it a criminal problem.
Which then, once they get out of prison, hinders them, like Michelle Alexander, who wrote the book The New Jim Crow, Colorblindness in the Age of Obama. You know, then when they come out saddled with these felony convictions, who's going to hire them? You know?
How can they get a job? Right now, you're stopped for resin in a pipe. You got 6 months. They take away your license, so you can't drive to get a job. And then they start piling on all of this fees, and then you can't mm-hmm. get off of probation until you pay the fees.
Right.
You can't stop and get a job, and so you can't pay the fees, so they put you back in jail. I mean, now, you know what they're doing in Utah is that if you get booked, it costs you $40. If you're in jail, it starts costing you $80 or $90 or $100-some-odd a day. So when you get out of jail, you got to pay the fees. If you don't pay your fees, then you get back thrown in jail.
Then what is the tax dollars going towards?
That's just adding income to the county.
That's going to salaries and stuff.
Or going to somebody.
True that.
The whole thing. It is a war on the indigenous families of this nation. The indigenous. And all you have to do is look at the population. People of color are the majority of people that are in prison. Period.
You know, I think I might have said this, and I know I've written about it, but a lot of people think, though, that it's the drugs that's destroying the family. And certainly, you know, I don't want to play on anybody's intelligence and say that, you know, people, drug-addicted individuals, especially when you're talking about drugs like crack cocaine, heroin, and other illicit drugs like that. You know, I'm not going to say that they don't cause problems in the family, that they don't destroy families in themselves. But, you know, if we focus more of our resources on getting these people the help that they so desperately need, I mean, come on. It's even getting hard for people. Look, for example, my daughter, my 20-year-old daughter is pregnant. She's having trouble finding a doctor who will treat her as a new patient. So, I mean, she's not even a drug addict or anything like that. So if a pregnant woman in this country is having difficulty finding a clinic that will take her, what does that tell you about our misplaced resources?
It's just sad, Scotty.
I mean, these individuals, I feel like, you know, if there wasn't such a stigma attached to it, if the penalties weren't so severe, and then they may come forward and get some help. But, you know, I read something lately about marijuana use going up among teenagers. Okay, alcohol use is going down. That's a good thing. And I feel like it's going down is because you got knuckleheads out here who may have thought about providing minors with alcohol are thinking twice about that now. Businesses do not want to lose their licenses serving alcohol to minors. And so like alcohol being legal, regulated, and taxed, I felt like if the same thing was going on with marijuana, we wouldn't see an increase in our teenagers using marijuana.
Yeah. Well, there's a solution out there now, and that is people seeing what and studying and understanding that the only way without any interference to end this war on drugs is becoming a member of a Native American church, because then they're protected, and that's the facts. But people don't want you to know that, I guarantee you. They just don't want you to know that, and they're doing everything in the world to keep you from knowing it, let me tell you. But there's a case that was won in federal court, in the 9th District Court, just this 15th of this month, where it basically, they confiscated 5 pounds of cannabis from our church that was being mailed from California into Hawaii. And the court said they dropped the injunction that we filed on the federal government because the federal government said they're not going to prosecute the people, nor will they take the cannabis out of the mail anymore. And the United States government wasn't too angry about that at all. But then when the judge said the Occoquan Native American Church president said, do you want to prosecute them for stealing your cannabis out of the mail? And they said yes. And on the 15th of this month, the 9th Circuit Court of Appeals, Ninth Circuit Court Chief Justices listened to the arguments, and then the argument is how much money the United States government is going to have to pay our church for taking the cannabis out of the mail because they violated federal law, the United States. So it's actually Occoquan Native American Church against the United States of America. The United States of America is the defendant.
Wow. That's a good turnaround right there. So,
well, it sure is.
So, you know, I just hope people will just take this information, arm themselves with this information, and spread it as well. Share it with your family members. You know, you could share this podcast right now by just hitting that Facebook share button or send a tweet out, because information is power, people. And as we was talking about last night, we got to know our rights. We have to know our rights. If you don't know your rights, then, you know, you're just walking around with a bullseye on your back, and, you know, they're going to do whatever, you know, to you. Now, James, we come to the end of this segment. I always, as you know, always give the guests the last word on the topic that we've been discussing. And if there's anything you want the listeners to take away from this program, what would that be? What would be that item that would be like flypaper on the wall that you want to stick to their mind?
I think, as I'm sitting here, and as you bring this up, Scotty, I have to say, know the law. Know the law. Knowledge is power. And another thing, realize we're brothers and sisters, each and every one of us, and go about things in a respectful manner of making changes like LEAP is doing. We're not out there on corners screaming and yelling and we want our rights. What we're doing is speaking to people and educating people, showing them the devastation factor of what these laws are, and then standing up. And that's what the Oklahoma Native American Church is doing. We stood up. My wife and I stood up first against the state of Utah and then against the United States of America. And by us standing by our commitments, standing up for who we are, we won. We won. And we did not fall into plea bargaining. We did not submit ourselves because we knew we were right. And the reason we knew that we were standing on solid ground is because we knew it because we studied. We understood the laws. We know what the essence of it. We know how the war on drugs came about. Or in this case, a war against the Native American church or the Native American culture. And we were committed to stand up. And we had the abilities because of our parents or whoever it was that gave us the stature to say, this is the truth. And we're not going to buckle under it. So if you have a card, you happen to be stopped, you happen to be arrested, do not plea bargain. You stand up for your rights because you will win when it comes down to it. You will win because our country is based off the United States Constitution, and eventually we will be living those standards and principles that our forefathers, who is also Native American from the Iroquois Nation, that helped write that Constitution, because that's what the forefathers did. They listened to those elders, those Native American elders, and they instituted those principles that the Iroquois Nation had and put it into the United States Constitution. And I'm saying to you, have faith in our government. Know that millions or thousands of American citizens have fought, have died to protect the principles of that Constitution. And sooner or later, we will be living it to the hilt.
Well said, James. And thank you once again for joining us. And I will definitely be in touch.
Thank you, Scotty. And it was a real honor to be with you.
And we'll be talking to you again real soon. Have a good night.
You too. Thank you.
You're listening to Black Talk Radio News with Scotty Reed. This program is part of the Black Talk Radio Network.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?